Today's program is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Did you know that Wisconsin wins more national and international cheese awards than any other state or country? To learn more, visit wisconsincheese.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
I love the way Dave like really blasts that last little chord out before I start talking. It just makes me feel so happy. It always makes me smile when it happens. It's funny. And that's a great way to start your program is with a big smile. Right, Dave? Anyway, we have a great show for you today. This is episode number 6 in my series on the dairy industry in the United States. And it is my very, very great pleasure to bring Gary Hirschberg onto the air to talk about the organic dairy industry. Gary, in case you are unfamiliar with him, which seems almost impossible, but I suppose it might be, is the chairman and co-founder of Stonyfield Farm, the world's leading organic yogurt producer. And he is also the author of Stirring It Up, How to Make Money and Save the World, which was published in 2008 by Hyperion. Gary frequently speaks on topics including sustainability, organic agriculture, and the profitability of green businesses. And his non-corporate life includes being chairman and a founding partner of Just Label It, We Have the Right to Know, the national campaign to label genetically engineered foods, and he is the co-author of Label It Now, What You Need to Know About Genetically Engineered Foods, which was published in 2012. He's also the chairman of Organic Voices, a consortium that seeks to eliminate consumer confusion about the benefits of organic, and in 2011, President Obama appointed him to serve on the Advisory Committee for Trade Policy and Negotiations, where he served until February 2017. And then also, it wasn't in your bio, Gary, but weren't you a founding member of Agri, capital A-G, lowercase R-E-E? Because I interviewed you about that when it first started, like literally 10 years ago.
Indeed, you have a good memory.
That was 10 years ago. That was like the very beginning of my career at Heritage Radio Network. And now, 10 years later, here we are chatting again. I like that symmetry, don't you?
It's nice to be back with you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a great pleasure. It really is an honor to have you on because you were such a pioneer. So I want you to give people, if for some reason they've been living under a rock for the last 30 years, just give them a little bit of an idea of what Stonyfield is all about, sort of how you got started and stuff.
Yeah, well, they would be forgiven. It was a long time ago. In the early days of Stonyfield, of course, very few Americans were even eating yogurt. This is 1983, and nobody knew what organic meant. So we often say that we had a wonderful company, just no supply and no demand. It was a real uphill battle in the early 80s, like a lot of wonderful brands. Whole Foods, of course, got their start then, as did many others, Organic Valley down the road from you and others. But I think in the early going, to be fair and honest, I don't think many of us organic advocates were as focused on the quality of the food, that is the taste, as we were on the benefits, the absence of pesticides and hormones and antibiotics and the benefits to farmers. But over that first decade, we really kind of got our act together, and I think consumers started to realize organic actually tastes better. And at the end of the day, with food, you can have all the features and benefits you want, but taste really rules. So that's really where we took off. So from 83, when we started with 7 cows, till obviously the present, where we're up now to supporting almost 1,500 family farms, it's been quite a ride.
Oh, that's fantastic. I love hearing that. We're going to talk a little bit more about that in a couple of minutes. But just compared to, first of all, how did you guys get started? You started with 7 cows, but you were able to buy enough land to support 7 cows at that time. And then I wanted you to sort of compare what it was like to try to acquire farmland in the 80s when you started, and sort of the obvious challenges that exist today. What was the climate like then in terms of acquisition?
I think the big, so just the quick background back then, and then I'll get to the present, which I think is, you're right, it's really an interesting and challenging time. you know, we were actually an organic farming school, and we were, in fact, renting the original farm. It was 140 acres. The reason it's called Stonyfield is that here in New England, that was really probably our best crop. You know, every year the stones would come up after each winter. And and we would, in fact, with our interns, and we would be out there, you know, hucking rocks into the rock piles for, you know, a couple days, weeks, really, when the season got started. So we grew our herd up to about 19 cows, but the truth was we were running a farm school, we were making yogurt, we were milking, it was just too much. So we started to look to other farmers as we as our demand kind of skyrocketed past our own capacity. Mm-hmm. And frankly, again, in the early 80s, there were very few farmers willing to take on the kind of practices that were engaged, access to pasture and not using antibiotics, for example. Right. Of course, synthetic growth hormone was coming on. We needed them to avoid that. So it was a slog. It wasn't so much a challenge for us of getting land as it was finding farmers who were willing to make that those changes and sacrifices, since, of course, the market itself was unknown to them. Fast forward to today, I think, you know, your listeners certainly are well aware that it's a very, very tough time for conventional dairy farming. Conventional farmers have higher feed prices and lower farm gate milk price than ever before. And so actually, we have a much easier time now accessing getting farmers who are willing to switch over, convert, as you know, it takes 3 years over to certified organic. In fact, the problem at this very moment is we actually have a surplus, not so much of milk in total, but of skim milk in particular, because so many farmers have realized that organic is the solution to the roller coaster ride with that they've been on with federal control of milk prices and again with skyrocketing feed prices and conventional, but the net is that now supply is a little bit farther ahead than demand, mainly because while cheese and whole milk products are up, skim milk is actually down. So so it's a tricky time, but certainly nowadays, we do not have the problem attracting farmers that we did in the early going.
Well, that's good to hear. But I wanted to ask you, like, does it cost more to produce? I mean, you sort of answered that question already because you said feed prices for commodity producers are higher than organic producers. So can you give us sort of an idea of the equation?
No, sorry, I misspoke.
Maybe I misunderstood.
What I'm saying is on the conventional side, feed prices are higher than they've ever been, and conventional milk price is very, very low.
Right,
on the organic side, actually, organic feed is often, and right now, in fact, so somewhere between 300 and 400%, 3 to 4 times more expensive than conventional. So that is the big challenge for our organic growers. And that's why we work really closely with farms who supply our milk to help them improve the quality of their pasture and their hay so they can rely more on nutrients grown on the farm and less on purchased feed.
Right.
But the organic price for milk is also much better at covering those costs and much less volatile. It's very steady. We're not we are under contract through our cooperative, which is Organic Valley or the Crop Cooperative, for about 90% of our milk. And then we have another 40 or so farms that we have a direct relationship. And those farmers can rely from year to year, let alone period to period, on a very steady price that's evolved at more on a supply and demand equation than on a than on the federal milk order, which is not always tied to market,
right,
as we know. So you know, the price for conventional milk is often well below these days what it costs farmers to produce it, which is why we've seen, you know, the decline in the number of small conventional dairy farms over the last decade, but also then why we've seen the increase of farmers willing to come over to organic. So, you know, part of what you get, just to cut to it, when you buy organic is that you can feel much more confident that the farmer is being paid a fair price, even with the higher feed costs. And it does mean organic milk costs more, but it's also one of the many reasons we think it's worth it. In the end, this is why we started this company in the first place, was to give farmers a fair shake and make sure that they were, you know, that family farmers are being adequately supported to stay on their land.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it reminds me, I mean, I was going to ask you about this later in the show, but it's what you're doing seems to be very similar to the Nyman Ranch model, where they basically guarantee a base price for pork and they never pay below that. And it sounds like you are able to do that with organic milk through your co-op.
Definitely, yeah. And, I mean, again, to be clear, the crop cooperative is a farmer-owned cooperative. So while they have a brand, Organic Valley, they are in business first and foremost to do exactly what I told you Stonyfield's founding mission was and still is, which is to ensure that farmers are adequately supported to do the heroic work they do every day.
Right.
So yes, most of our milk, 90% comes from a co-op that is absolutely there, not just to provide an adequate price, but to provide technical services, help farmers be more efficient on the cost side and on purchasing and so forth. And, you know, with our direct farms, we developed a direct supply mainly in the Northeast, Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, New York, and here we're experimenting even further. For example, every farm in our direct supply has access to about $5,000 worth of technical assistance per farm per year, so they can decide what they want to focus the support on, you know, pasture improvement or milk quality, or even sometimes bringing a lawyer on or reducing their insurance costs. But the point is, we're always, I mean, I don't think the co-op nor we are ever done trying to improve the model, which is to find ways that to help farmers be more in control of their economic destiny. Organic goes a long, long way towards that. The pricing has been very, very stable. If I showed you two charts next to each other, if you saw the conventional milk price, it looks like a literally up and down, up and down, up and down.
Yeah.
Whereas organic pay price to farmers now for some time has been quite a steady curve with no volatility.
So how do you do that, Gary? I mean, like, because you're not part of the federal price support or the federal price setting?
Yeah, no, that's the art. I mean, the challenge, of course, is first of all, you know, most consumers aren't aware of this at all. So, so frankly, we really appreciate your giving us an opportunity to talk today, because I think a lot of this is just helping consumers know that when they're buying organic, they're really supporting something more than just reducing pesticides or hormones or antibiotics to their families. That, of course, is a big part of the benefit to them. But they're really supporting a different kind of system. But what we have to do here, frankly, is you know, balancing supply and demand is the hardest thing in with most commodities, but milk in particular. And so we, as the kind of the bridge between the consumer and the farmer, have to ensure that we're keeping our costs absolutely under control to always favor the farmer, the pay price to the farmer.
Right.
So what it means very bluntly is we can't, for example, do very much in the way of advertising. You know, we're up against General Mills or Denon or
Hood,
you know, some of the Chobani companies that don't have don't have an organic portfolio, or in Denon's case, it's a tiny fraction. And so they have much cheaper milk, and therefore they can make more profit, more gross margin on their products, and then use it to buy advertising. We typically have never, I mean, periodically we'll do print ads, or social media has been a lot less expensive, but this is a big, big gap. For the business savvy listeners out there, my gross margin out the back of my milk price is much more expensive, almost twice what they pay, and yet my gross margin is about 10 points worse than theirs. In other words, I can't charge as much to make up for the high cost of my milk. So I've got to make it up somewhere, or else I don't have a viable business. And mainly we make it up with less advertising.
Amazing. It's incredible. Let me ask you this. Why hasn't every single small-scale dairy turned into an organic? I mean, given the volatility of the prices and the fact that, you know, it's basically, what is it, like $15 a hundredweight now? I mean, below the cost of production. So why haven't more farmers gone into organic, or would that just end up being creating the same glut as they are facing in conventional dairy.
Yeah, that's the problem. I mean, I think many, many more would. And again, at this very moment right now, we've even had to put our farmers on quotas to limit their production. And by the way, one of our competitors, Horizon, is actually they're closing off. They're not renewing contracts with farmers, particularly in the West. They're so oversupplied. So it's a it's a dark moment right now. The issue is you asked how do we do it, and that's a big part of our job. We have to continue to drive demand to keep up with the interest in supply. Obviously, I mean, just if I could step back for one second in the big picture. So the good news is organic in 2017, we'll have the actual USDA data out shortly, but I can tell you it crossed the $50 billion mark in annual sales nationally, which is phenomenal. I mean, when we started, it was you could measure organic writ large in the millions, and now it's up over $50 billion.
Yeah,
that's the good news. The bad news is it's still around 5.5% of total U.S. food. So, really, to get what you're talking about, to get to meet the you've got two mega trends, right? One, organic farmers can make more money; they can be sustainable. And two, you get more young farmers who clearly understand organic. They want to raise their families on organic farms, and so on. And so, our job is to receive as much of that milk, buy as much as we can, but also keep driving demand. And as I said before, the real trick here is we can't afford all the advertising that the cheaper, that the brands who don't pay as much for milk, are engaged in. So, you watch Chobani, sort of come from nowhere to now the number, actually they're now the number two yogurt brand in the country, but they did it on the backs, frankly, of not paying farmers an adequate amount. The conventional milk has just not been kind to farmers. So, our job, our challenge is in the long run, we think it's the right challenge to take on, but it's certainly a lot more difficult. But, the good news in all of this is that the millennial consumer today, and again, half of all millennials are now parents, really understand organic better than at any time in our history. Of course, they want to know how everything's grown. They want to know who's growing it. They want to know about the animal welfare practices. Sure. They want to know, is the farmer being paid adequately? They want to know, everything there is to know because they're a lot more educated than we were. And that, of course, inevitably leads them to organic because, while there are plenty of other labels out there like fair trade or non-GMO or, animal welfare, in the end, organic is the one that checks all those boxes. So the wind is blowing our way. It's just, again, that the art is balancing this increasing interest of farmers with demand.
Yeah, absolutely. And given that Americans are eating or drinking less milk, I mean, of course, you're not really in the fluid milk business. You're in the yogurt business. But I'm wondering, why can conventional farmers sort of, piggyback on that added value thing? I mean, and do more sort of other types of milk products themselves? Would that help them with conventional farming, or is that really once again the business of the co-op? And I want to talk a little bit more about co-ops in a second. But
sure,
No,
it's a great question, and I've been doing this for, this is literally our 35th year. Seen sort of a lot, and one of the things I've seen is a lot of attempts on the part of conventional to try to slay that dragon. So, for example, you'll see a lot more of these local milks in glass bottles. Everywhere in the country now. Generally, there's one enterprising farm entrepreneur will have done this. You see a lot of milks declaring themselves synthetic growth hormone free, free of RBST, and these are good attempts, and in some cases, very localized cases, they're often successful. But the problem, as I say, at the mass scale, is that you've got this terrible, terrible situation that the gap between their costs and what they can get for price, even with value added, is just so great. It's just too much to overcome. And we obviously, you know, we support all farmers, organic or conventional. We really believe family farmers are the lifeblood of our country and need to be supported. But we've just found that organic is the smoother and more stable path. We just need to drive demand up past that 10% mark I talked about. And by the way, I want to just say, so I don't confuse your listeners, that while I was giving statistics of overall organic, all organic, you know, vegetables, right, fruits, the whole nine yards in that $50 billion figure, in fact, organic dairy is following the trend pretty closely. Organic dairy is also around 5.5%. And organic yogurt, which, as you point out, is our primary business, we do a small amount in fluid, is also around that 5.5%. Mm-hmm. The places where organic has overachieved is, for example, carrots, which is now something like 20% of America's carrots, and you're seeing fruits coming up. But dairy is right at the average, and so again, my obsession, my title is Chairman and Chief Organic Optimist here. my obsession is driving us to that 10%, that double digit mark. And again, the happy news is the millennial consumer really gets it.
Yeah.
We just have to balance meet retailers' demands that we hit the same velocities they expect from the cheaper the products that use cheaper ingredients.
Right, right. And what about before we move on to co-ops? What about I know that Stonyfield has a European branch now. In fact, you're owned by a much bigger company at this point, and so you're trying to open markets in other areas around the globe. And I'm just curious, Is there a big demand for organic milk in other countries, like say in Western Europe or say in, I don't know, South America or something like that? Are they sort of latching onto that idea, or are you still really just a pioneer in those markets trying to make that happen?
Yeah. So just to clarify, Stonyfield, we sold the company to Danone in 2001, right, and as part of the arrangement that I had with them, I continued to run Stonyfield independently while I was CEO for another 10 years. I'm still the chairman, but I also started something called Stonyfield Europe then, right, and Le de Vache, the little organic yogurt brand that my colleagues and I started over there, is in fact the fastest growing yogurt that Danone has in all of Europe, and it's growing just furiously. The organic market in Europe was actually a little bit behind in most countries. You get a few like Austria where it's been overperforming. But just I want to be clear, Danone had to sell Stonyfield last year due to what happened was they went out and acquired another large organic dairy, and that the Department of Justice required that they divest of Stonyfield. So you're right. Now we're owned by a company called Lactalis, which is probably the biggest dairy company no one's ever heard of. They're a $23 billion entirely family-owned company.
Amazing.
Absolutely an extraordinary company. And one of the reasons I was thrilled that Lactalis bought the company, and this is why I've become a lot more engaged, is they welcomed, one of the first things they did was they sat down with me and said, you know, how can we get you more involved again? One of the reasons I was thrilled is they were the first, 20 years ago, they were the first to launch organic milk in Europe. Mm-hmm. And now they're a global company, and indeed, to your point, they are watching organic and wanting us here at Stonyfield to help them, watching organic grow in many, many parts of the world, even in Asia and Australia. So in general, organic dairy is enjoying around a 20%+ compounded growth rate on average globally. And as I say, some countries are starting further behind. Western Europe, it's catching up very fast. It's now again about the same, sort of 5-7%. Mm-hmm. And the future is very bright. You've got young farmers who want to go to organic. You've obviously got consumers demanding, and now you have these large, well-funded multinationals like Lactalis who are supporting that trend. So we are a part of a North American group of companies here with them, but again, the way they operate is they keep these companies very, very separate. Like I said, they wanted me to come back in as a more active chair. I'm now very much more engaged in new product development and communications and supply chain management than I have been for many years here. And it's really because they want us to run as a separate entity, which is wonderful.
Yeah, that is fantastic. Gary, stay on the line. We're going to take a short break now for a sponsor drop, and we'll be right back with Gary Hirschberg, and we're going to be talking about co-ops with him, why some of them work and some of them don't. So stay tuned.
Welcome all you strangers to the great divide. Today's program was brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. What do you think of when you hear Wisconsin cheese? For me, I think cheese curds. Delicious, fresh and squeaky cheese curds. Or deep fried cheese curds. Cheese curds literally any way, anytime, any place. I think about Andy Hatch and Uplands Cheese, the farmstead cheese company behind Pleasant Ridge Reserve. I think of delicious stinky Limburger and its long storied history. I think of Dunbarton Blue, made by master cheesemaker Chris Raleigh. I think of Ross Grand Cru Sirchois, which was named 2016's World Championship Cheese, and Satori's Black Pepper Bellavitano, the 2017 U.S. Championship Cheese. Wisconsin produces the world's best cheese, with lush grasslands and a glacial water supply that produce the very best milk. Fourth-generation cheesemakers combine old-world tradition with new ideas and the highest standards to make innovative cheeses that win more awards than any other state or country. To learn more, visit wisconsincheese.com.
And a very fitting sponsor drop there for this series anyway. I don't know why they haven't been our person the whole way through. But I realized I didn't introduce the show or myself at the beginning. So just in case you're tuning in right now, this is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights, and I'm Katie Kiefer, and this is the Heritage Radio Network. So we are talking to Gary Hirschberg today, who is the founder and CEO of Stonyfield. Now you're the chairman, because Stonyfield has moved on to bigger and better things, becoming almost a global company. But Gary, let's go back and talk about those co-ops, because, you know, in the talking to a conventional dairy farmers, I always hear the words, the Dairy Farm Association, DFA, Dairy Farm Association, which is the biggest member-supported co-op in the industry, if I'm not mistaken. And I kind of feel like we can point the finger at them in terms of milk prices being as low as they are. And I wondered how that is the case with that very large co-op, and yet other co-ops seem to be doing much better by their members. And can you sort of differentiate between how your co-op works and how DFA works, for instance? Or is that like not territory you want to head into?
Well, I can hit half of that, Katie. So let me also just go back and clarify. Stonyfield is actually not a global company. We are owned by a global company. We're really only here in the U.S.
Okay.
We have sister relationships around the world. And again, under the new owner, Lactalis, I'm hoping that we will be able to help start and help spur similar growth of small, organic companies around the world. And a big part of our growth, to your point, has been our partnership with the CROP Cooperative. CROP stands for Cooley Region Organic Produce Pool. They're based in Wisconsin. In the early going, when we were all starting, you know, with our very small number of farms and small number of cows, there were a dozen or so members of their co-op. Today, they're up to 1,600.
Wow.
And what your listeners would be interested in is that their average herd size nationally is 90 cows. So this is not, you know, mega farms. This is truly a family farm cooperative. And of course, they're into all kinds of products, but we are their largest customer and a really critical partner, not just because we buy so much milk from them, but also because, you know, we share the same values and goals, and also they sell a lot of cheese and butter, and we buy a lot of skim milk for our fat-free products. So we're a very complimentary.
Yeah.
You know, as a rule, I don't know that I could really answer your question because this is the one co-op that I know the best. What I would say about them, in other words, it's hard for me to comment on DFA, but here what I would say is they are truly farmer-owned. They are all about not just improving the price that farmers get, but obviously, at the end of the day, you know, it's about delivering products that consumers can afford, whether in the form of Stonyfield yogurt or their own products. And so they also work really hard. And where I think I'm proudest of their association is they work really hard at farmer efficiency. One of the things that this co-op does so well, and we've benefited from it and learned so much from it, is they provide literally, you know, veterinary and technical assistance at every level, whether you're trying to improve your soil tilth, your forage quality, your animal nutrition, your animal health. They literally have veterinarians on staff and so on. So, you know, I have farmers down the road from me here who milk good friends who've been with us for a long time who actually make money milking 30 cows, which is unheard of, right, in modern conventional agriculture.
Pretty much.
But they do it because they're just a lot more efficient. They've developed ways of reducing on-farm inputs. What happened for us, I started to tell you this earlier, Katie, is that we, you know, around 2013, with all this wonderful growth we've enjoyed as their co-op has grown and our brand has grown, we did notice that here in the Northeast, organic dairying was shrinking, the number of farmers in particular. And so that's why we decided to go ahead and launch our own mini kind of local cooperative of about 40 farms. And again, it's not instead of, it's in addition to. We still get most of our milk from the Organic Valley Cooperative. But this allows us to work directly and closely on things that you know, that are very particular to the Northeast, whereas Organic Valley is a national co-op. So they're, you know, as a national co-op, they have to deal with, you know, issues like California drought or you know, issues that vary by region. Here in the Northeast, we have our own particular challenges, mainly the higher costs of feed because of our weather conditions. We're farther from, you know, the commodity markets and also fuel prices up here, whether for transportation or just in general, are obviously much higher. So our Organic Valley farmers and our direct farms up here have very particular programs tailored to these conditions, and they've just been a great partner. We have you know, the same veterinarian who works with their farmers works directly with our farmers, and you know, it's a fight for survival here in the Northeast, and I think together we're waging that war pretty well.
Well, that's encouraging. I mean, I interviewed Rhody Fresh, which is a little tiny dairy in my home state, Rhode Island, where I live most of the time. And, you know, they're part of the AgriMark co-op because they're a conventional dairy. And, you know, I'm sort of hard put to see where, what exactly AgriMark is bringing to the party aside from distribution. Rhody Fresh itself is really just a marketing and distribution platform themselves. I mean, they, you know, they market, but they can't really offer they only have 5 farms in their co-op actually. And Rhode Island now only has 9 dairy farms. And to speak to your point about, you know, that the organic, sector is kind of diminishing in Rhode Island or in New England, wouldn't that speak as much to the number of people who are just giving up on dairying in general and, you know, selling their land off to, you know, to developers or whatever? I mean, that seems to be happening a lot in my home state. And I wouldn't be surprised if New Hampshire followed suit.
As I say, there's a lot of unique challenges in all of our states up here. You know, when we started Stonyfield in 1983, there were over 500 dairy farms in the state. When I was growing up, there were over 2,000.
Yeah.
Last year, we crossed the 100 mark. We're now under 100 for the first time since, you know, there was farming in this region.
Right.
And again, you know, that's primarily the decline of conventional, not organic.
Right.
Organic is winning. I mean, we're more of those conventional farmers are converting, but again, we need to keep demand up with supply. Now we're in this odd little moment. And by the way, I need to be clear about this. This challenge of balancing supply and demand, this is always the problem for processors. So when you know, talk about AgriMark and the conventional co-ops, what I would say is I empathize with their plight. You've got higher feed costs, and because of a lot of factors, lower pay price. You know, consumers want cheap food, and so conventional, no matter how good a co-op is, they're stuck in this economic paradigm that I think is, you know, it's a tough one to break. We, like I said, we've figured out that the way to break it is to go organic. We get a higher pay price to the farmers, more stable and declining costs. Your listeners may not even know, for example, that organic cows live twice as long and produce twice as long as conventional farmers. And so if you're a farmer with 30 or 300 cows, if your primary asset is produced productive twice as long, that's you're making you a lot more efficient. So, you know, I'm an optimist, right? My wife calls me a pathological optimist. And, you know, I believe that even though organic costs more and we're up against you know, brands that sell with much cheaper inputs, I do believe in the long run we're winning here. And again, I believe it mainly because I see these younger consumers who are, you know, they're thrifty. A lot of them have graduated with college debt, so they're not like they're flowing in dollars, but they're gonna they may buy one you know, a cheaper or used car or you know, or something. They may not move into the most expensive, you know, housing or whatever, but they make choices in favor of better food for you and better food for the planet. And this is a this is what's driving our business. Our fastest growing sector at Stonyfield is our kids lines, kids and baby yogurts. Why? Because, again, you've got this new consumer who recognizes that, you know, we are what we eat. You know, cancer is cancer rates are on the rise, and what oncologists and leading cancer panels tell us and them is that the number one reason that cancer rates have been on the rise is day-to-day exposure to toxins in lots of ways, but primarily in our food. So we've got, like I say, the wind at our backs. Our job as a processor, like the co-ops you're asking about, is really to keep innovating choices for consumers that will keep demand growing.
Yeah, and that's a hard thing to do because right now you also have competition from plant-based, quote-unquote, milks. And I don't see how changing the name of one of those products is going to be. You know what I mean? Like you see a lot in this sort of dairy pages, like on Facebook, or if you follow any of those groups, you know, people are all up in arms because they almond milk calls itself a milk. Well, you know, that is not going to change. You know, calling it something else is not going to people not buy it or you know, not substitute it for conventional milk. But do you feel like those plant-based products are having an impact on the organic sector? Do you think that's also driving sort of, you know, driving some aspect of your business?
Well, I would say, if you were to ask me to put in slightly different words, what are the primary competitive challenges we've got? I would say number one is large conventional brands that portray themselves as better for you, better for the planet, but they're really not paying the freight. You know, I mentioned Chobani, for example, that, you know, on the backs of low prices paid to farmers, you know, Danone is to be congratulated for going non-GMO with their yogurts. But again, you know, there's still plenty of herbicides and chemicals being used in non-GMO. And you know, if you look at the vast bulk of their lines, and obviously Yoplait, General Mills, the other top three brand, you know, they have this incredible advantage when they're paying less than half of what we're paying for milk. They just have a much more money to spend on marketing, and of course they can price themselves cheaper. So that, in terms of competitive threat, that is a monster. Then the plant-based trend, which is, I think, very hopeful, frankly, because it belies a consumer who's being a lot more discerning and trying to sort of, you know, curate for their family. I happen to be on the board of one plant-based yogurt and milk company that's doing, you know, extraordinarily well. It's still pretty small, but for sure it's cutting into, you know, dairy sales as a trend. You know, one third of Americans are lactose intolerant, so it's a trend that has been, I think, sort of you know, latent and for a long time. And now the problem is that a lot of the plant-based options have not tasted that great until recently. Our Osoy yogurt, for example, has done incredibly well and continues to, but we're always looking at other opportunities. And now you see, you know, coconut, almond, cashew, oat, you know, there's a lot of, consumers have a lot more options. But the key point, back all the way back to my earlier comment about organic in the 80s, is that while a lot of these products have been around, they're now starting to really crack the taste thing. And so, you know, in my view, this is, you know, we have to be all about consumer choice. I believe the rising tide lifts all boats. If you go into a natural food store or a grocery store looking for plant-based products, hopefully you're going to find your way to organic. That's good. That's in the end what we have to do. Don't forget, as a yogurt company, we buy a lot more than just milk, right? We buy lots of fruits and flavorings and so forth. And so the more organic demand that's out there, the more we're supporting these farmers. And frankly, in the long run, the more we can keep that premium over conventional pricing within range of what consumers can afford. So more is better, whether it's plant-based or dairy, as far as I'm concerned.
That's great. That was a really good pitch. can see why they pay you the big
Thank
bucks,
you.
Gary. Okay, we unfortunately have to wrap this up, but I have one big question, like a really big question for you, and you have like 3 or 4 minutes to answer it. You know, a lot of farmers obviously hate, and this is sort of more about conventional dairy actually than organic, but I mean just sort of the dairy industry in general. What, you know, do you see a role for government? I know that most farmers hate the idea of government meddling in their business in any way at all, but do you see government playing a role on some level in helping to preserve the dairy industry as it, you know, on a smaller scale, in other words, not the big mega dairies that we see out in Wisconsin and what's, you know, that are producing, you know, that have 10,000 cows or whatever. What can they do with the farm bill or whatever to help? Yeah, totally.
I mean, the system is broken. That's exactly what's going on. And you know, last week the budget deal that was passed did include a small fix to the Dairy Margin Protection Program. This was championed by Senator Leahy of Vermont that will, you know, hopefully make the conventional program work better for conventional producers. But you know, the conventional price, as you pointed out, has been below the cost of production for several years now.
Yeah.
And so this margin protection program is really only a tweak. Look, I think the critical role that government needs to play is to pave the way for 21st century agriculture. And that means more and more support for organic. You know, right now there's this indefensible position that the USDA has taken, which is a rollback of organic standards, and
yes,
it's the biggest attack on organic in almost 20 years. There's a new animal welfare rule that we've been trying to get passed. It was brought together by stakeholders representing farmers, ranchers, food processors, all overwhelmingly supporting stronger, clearer standards. But a handful of big, huge commodity producers have used their financial weight to keep the USDA from moving forward on standards as simple as just making sure that animals have access to sunlight and fresh air. We engage in these practices because we believe in them, but it would be nice to have the government standing behind them. And frankly, organic research is way behind funding of conventional. You know, there's just a lot more that the government can do. I'm not terribly optimistic that this particular administration is going to get us there, but government has a role, but you know, they're not playing it now, and we all need to keep working on that.
Yeah, I agree. So, you know, remember that when you talk to a congresswoman or congressman or senator the next time, because I mean, we're all in the habit now of phoning them on a regular basis, right?
So, listen, I'll just say quickly, I know we've got to go, but you know, any of your listeners needs to understand it is now 2018. We have probably the most important election in our lifetimes, and I don't care what party you're in coming this fall, but we darn well better support candidates who prioritize the environment and prioritize the things that we want for our children. Right now, you can only define call the Environmental Protection Agency the Chemical Protection Agency with the deregulation that's going on. And again, the abandonment of strong organic support is one of the, you know, true crimes here. It's good for farmers. It's good for consumers. It's good for the planet. It's good for exports. It's good for our balance of trade. It's preventative health care. We need a government that supports that, whatever party you support. So I do hope people take you seriously and pay attention, because this is a most crucial election I've ever seen.
Yeah, absolutely. Watershed moment. Now, Gary, this is the moment where you get to promote yourself shamelessly. And so talk to us about your other passions, which include, the Just Label It campaign. Whatever happened to Agri? That went away with the Obama administration?
No. Agri is it's nonpartisan. It's still going strong. You can get your listeners can get on the Agri daily news feed. But my main passion these days. Well, first of all, just to be clear, the Just Label It's work is not done. There is a we're waiting for when the national labeling bill was passed a year and three quarters ago. It required that the USDA come out with final rules that will stipulate what the national label needs to look like by July of this year. So we're waiting eagerly for those rules to come out. And, you know, as you might imagine, I'm sure it's going to be challenging. So we're gearing up. You know, we had the largest number of consumers in the history of the federal government sign a petition and get calls into Congress to demand higher standards. So that fight is not over. We have our work cut out, but they do have to publish and put those rules in effect by the end of July. So that's one main passion, and then the other is honestly what we've talked about here. Yeah. And you know, there's a little farm here in Maine called Wolf's Neck Farm. It's a wonderful nonprofit where, you know, thousands and thousands of school kids have gone. But we're working with them on the one of the biggest challenges we have is that the average farmer age, organic or not, is 58 years old here in the Northeast. And so we've started the first ever organic dairy apprenticeship program. We're graduating our first students this spring.
Congratulations!
Literally helping young people to get paid for 18 months to learn all the ins and outs of running a dairy farm and a dairy farm business without having all the financial risk that startup farmers have. So that's exciting. And with Wolf's Neck, Stonyfield is working very hard on tracking and supporting what we call regenerative organic practices, practices that measure just the dramatically greater amounts of organic matter being trapped in soil than happens with conventional. Meaning, if we're going to really reverse climate change, agriculture is going to have to play a critical role, and organic plays a better role. We now know you trap a lot more carbon in soil with organic. So we're documenting that and building a national network of 500 farms who are tracking best practices. So plenty to do, all in the name of both keeping family farmers successful, but also delivering what I think consumers really want, which is, you know, I've yet to meet the consumer who says, give me more pesticides in my food, right? So it's
right.
It's about less processing, less inputs, better for the environment, and ultimately better for our children.
Well, that's a beautiful way to end the show. So thank you so much, Gary, for joining me today and helping us understand some of the ins and outs of organic. And, you know, I wish you the best with Stonyfield and all the other ventures that you're involved in. And thanks,
Katie,
so
thank
much.
Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. And thanks for my sponsor, Wisconsin Cheese. And that's all for today, folks. We'll see you next week. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.